Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. You're with me today. My name is Charlotte White, but you can call me Charlie. I've been left the reins today as one of History Hack's resident Ricardians, a title of which I'm very proud, to speak to today's guest. I'm joined by Michelle Schindler, who has studied at Johann Wolfgang Goethe University in Frankfurt, reading English studies and history with a focus on medieval studies. Now, we're definitely in an interesting area here. She's the author of Lovell Our Dog, The Life of Viscount Lovell, and he's the closest friend of Richard III and a failed regicide. I think we're going to have some very interesting things to talk about today. Hello, Michelle.
Hello.
So the cat, the rat, and Lovell Our Dog do rule all England under a hog.
Yeah, that's the one.
So look, let's be predictable. Let's start at the beginning. What do we know about Lovell's early life? And he's associated with Richard III from a very early age, isn't he?
Well, we don't know all that much about his childhood, as we barely know about anyone's childhood, really. But what we know, it's fairly common. He had a couple of siblings. He had a twin sister, which is a bit unusual for the time. They both lived. So both lived to adulthood. And he had an older brother who died, that sort of thing. But there seems to have been some kind of trouble with the father, to the point that he later on wouldn't have prayers read for him, which is very unusual. He had them read for his grandfather, whom he didn't even meet, but not for his father, repeatedly. So there was some sort of trouble, but we do not know what. Just there was probably some difficulty.
You've got to really not like somebody in your family to not offer prayers for them at this time.
Yes, so something happened. But what it is, we can guess, but we just don't know. Mm. And he was very young when his father died. He was only 8, so who knows what happened. But from that time on, when he was 8, that's when he would have met Richard. His father was dead, so he became a ward of the king. Mm-hmm. And the king gave him to his cousin Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick, to bring up. And that's where Richard also was in that year. He was also given to Warwick to raise that year. Richard would have been 12 and Francis would have been around 8. And that's we of course don't know if the 12-year-old and the 8-year-old immediately became friends. They would have known difficulties from a young age, so maybe they bonded over that. But we don't know. We do know that from the time on, they both were old enough to make their own decisions. In teenage years, they're often found together, so maybe that's where it started. But we know they were both there at the same time. We do not know what their relationship was at that point, because they were both still pretty young.
Gosh. And they were under who we now know as Warwick the Kingmaker.
Yes, that's him.
A very powerful man to be brought up with.
Yes, I think it would have been for Richard, it would have been expected, but the Lovell family had not been all that important. There were a couple of barons, a couple of ancestors of Francis who had been at court, but none of them had ever been all that important. So maybe it was special for the young boy to be brought into contact with somebody that important, that powerful. He probably wouldn't have known anything like it before that.
Amazing. I'd love to just to be a fly on the wall in that house.
Yes. And it would have been probably quite overwhelming for an 8-year-old to suddenly be there in the center of power, so to speak, or one of the centers of power anyway.
Gosh. So do we know anything about Lovell's character? There's debates about Richard's character, thanks to, you know, Shakespeare, one of the best propaganda plays ever produced. But what's his ride or die closest friend like? And do you think it can give us a little bit of an insight into Richard?
It can, in a way, because Francis was, he was about the most uncontroversial person around. Even in all the propaganda that followed Richard's death, he was barely mentioned. Nobody ever accused him of anything, absolutely nothing. Even that the cat, the rat, and Love Our Dog, there was this one guy who was angry at the people who had power at the time, but you would think that this would give later propaganda writers a good chance to also attack his character. Nothing, absolutely nothing.
Wow.
He was extremely unpolitical, even at the time. There's no evidence at all of him trying to wrest power from somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to have been reserved, you're almost shy, and quite unconventional, really. That's the thing with the not having any prayers, that you had to be a special sort of person to to make that decision. Even if you didn't like your father, you had to be, you had to be sure of yourself and sure of knowing that you could ignore conventions if it suited you. He was sort of emotional like that.
Yeah.
And mostly, that's interesting. He did, even when he rebelled or something, he didn't make a lot of song and dance about it. He just did it. So he was a calm guy. And it's interesting that Richard, who from the sources was more ostentatious, perhaps, chose a man like that as his closest friend. And he was not politically important before Richard became king, not at all. He had barely any power, and any time he tried to do anything military, he failed. So he wouldn't have been able to give Richard a lot in the way of political support or military support.
Mm.
So it's interesting for him to have this man so close to him to favor him that much. And I think this says a lot about Richard. He wasn't just looking around for support. Of course he had to, but this relationship was not one of those.
No, of course. Well, his motto was loyalty binds me. So maybe he was loyal to Lovell.
Yes, that could be. Or maybe just liked each other.
So their ties, they're not just about having grown up together. He's got a marriage connection to Richard, I understand. So tell us about how that comes about. And do we know anything about Lovell as a husband? Is he a decent sort of husband?
Yes, we actually had two marital relations to Richard. The first of all was through his own wife. That was the niece of Warwick the Kingmaker, the daughter of his sister Alice and her husband Henry Baron Fitzhugh.
Mm-hmm.
And Fitzhugh was therefore Richard's first cousin once removed. So she was related to Richard the same way his own wife was. And of course, Richard's wife and Neville and Fitzhugh, all named the same for maximum confusion, were first cousins. Francis was the first cousin of Richard's wife through marriage, and he was the first cousin once removed to Richard himself through marriage. So yeah, and he was also the step grandson of Richard's aunt.
Okay, this starts to get very confusing. We need a tree.
Yes. No, his the older sister of Cecily Neville, that's Richard's mother, was married to Francis's grandfather.
Okay, right. I can see it now. I can see it through Cecily. It gets so complicated, doesn't it, at the top?
Yes, it's terrible. And the woman who was later claimed to have been married to Edward the Fourth before Elizabeth Woodville. Mm-hmm. No, I'm not getting into whether it was or not, but she was, I think she was his cousin by marriage, Francis's cousin by marriage, through another grandmother. So you just have this whole nobility, and it's a bramble bush, it's not a tree.
I love that. It's a bramble bush, not a tree. I'm going to use that. That's fantastic.
We actually know that he was quite good a husband. We have an indenture in his own words from 1485, yes, And he leaves his wife a lot of manors that she could own. And especially, he actually managed to disinherit his own cousin so she could keep them and she could possibly leave them to any children she had with another man after his death.
That's
so this says a lot about what he may have felt.
And how he valued his wife over his other family, over the cousins, to take from them to favor the wife.
Yes. Yes. It's even an indenture if the family protests this and that. So he anticipated that, because probably the cousin, that's Henry Lord Morley, wouldn't have been all that happy about it.
So he set that up, did he? He set up that it would definitely go to her, even if they fought it.
Yes, yes. In the event he didn't, but because he got attainted, but he couldn't know that.
That's jumping ahead in our story, definitely. Does he have any children?
No, we have evidence of her having one miscarriage, but no living children. We don't know why. He seemed to think it was his fault, but of course we can't know.
Oh, that's incredible that he would think it was his fault. That doesn't seem like a very sort of common stance in medieval men.
Not at all, especially since she wasn't a widow who had already had some children, where you could say, well, it must be logically. Yeah. And she had, as I say, we have evidence she was pregnant once, so it could have been either of them, but he seemed to think it was his fault.
I feel bad for him. I feel bad for him through time. So how does his life change when his best mate, Richard, becomes King Richard III?
Quite a lot, because he was not political before that at all. He was rarely at court, that we know. He'd only been to Parliament once. And then suddenly Richard just heaped him with favors. He heaped him with everything. One of his first acts as Lord Protector was granting him some manners that he'd been arguing with Richard Grey about. This on the first day we have action of Richard as Lord Protector. That's when it happened.
God, so that is his first. The first thing he does,
yes,
is he takes away from the Grey family.
Yes.
Which is the family of Elizabeth Woodville?
Yes, that's the younger son of Elizabeth Woodville by her first husband that they were arguing about.
That is very interesting. For any listeners who aren't sort of familiar with this time, Elizabeth Woodville, as the wife of Edward IV, her family have a terrible reputation, don't they, for rabbing?
Yes. Yes, they do. There's some evidence of, well, Edward favoring them, and whenever there was an argument between nobles about a manor or some land, which they always happened, he usually said that the Woodvilles were right. I mean, it's sort of to be expected, because, well, she was married to the king, but she wasn't that high-born, so all the other old nobles were complaining about it. They would have been complaining about it anyway, but especially like so, because why does this lowborn nobody get it?
It's absolutely incredible. And she wasn't really that lowborn. Her mother was Jacquetta of Luxembourg. She's not a commoner, inverted commas.
No, she's not. The father is, but he was later made a baron as well, so, and then an earl by Edward, but Gullet was snobbish.
Yeah, of course.
Very much.
But it's fascinating that first present for Lovell comes at the expense of the Grey family.
Yeah. And to be fair, he had been arguing with them about it. He was actually related to the Greys some generations back, because of course he was.
They're all related to each other. It's a bramblebush, people.
Yes.
So what job does he give Lovell? What's his position?
First of all, he was made chief butler. That's again at the expense of the Woodvilles, because Anthony Woodville, that's the Dowager Green's brother had been chief butler when Edward was king, and then he died and Richard had Anthony arrested. Mm. And then somebody needed to be chief butler, so that was Francis. And then later on, when Richard was king, he became Lord Chamberlain. So that's the person who is in charge of making sure who can have access to the king and who can't. For Edward, it had been William Hastings, so another close friend. It was usually a close friend. These people were also responsible for all sorts of physicians and other people in the household, and they also had to make sure that any organization like weddings, funerals, meetings were went well. So it was massively important and quite the responsibility, really.
Amazing. He's basically in charge of the household, isn't he?
Yes.
Which doesn't sound very, now we think of a butler and sort of a head of the household as being some sort of, you know, perhaps not a high status position, but this at this time is, you know, top job.
It's amazing. And it would have been nothing at all like we think of butlers. He may have been sort of three steps removed in that he chose somebody who was actually doing the job we now associate with butlers, but probably this would have been too lowly for him to even decide.
Amazing. So he has to do some sort of heavy work as well, because this is medieval times we're talking about. He's charged with defending the south against Henry Tudor's invasion when this usurper comes from across the sea. Sorry, I apologise. Terrible Ricardian. How does that go for him? How does it go for Lovell?
Quite badly. as usual, he wasn't a military man at all. It was a mix-up, really, and it's probably not his fault, but he waited at the wrong Milford. There's two Milfords down south somewhere, and he just got the wrong one. It's interesting he was even charged with that, because there's absolutely no evidence he was ever on a boat before. And then he was given all the charge of, commanding the fleet to guard against the usurper coming in. Sorry, the future Henry VII coming in.
Yeah, we don't need to pretend here, Michelle. Don't worry. we can call it as it is. That is absolutely incredible. So he's got no military experience, never been on a boat, and is...
He's got some military experience. He worked with Richard in Scotland, and he tried to raise men during the Buckingham Rebellion, and that failed. So, yeah.
Oh dear. And he goes to the wrong... I can't get over that. He goes to the wrong...
It may not have been his fault. It may have been a mix-up in the spies saying so. Nobody blamed him. It was just there's a small mention in the Croyland Chronicle saying it was Milford, but it was the wrong Milford.
No. How does he react to events at Bosworth?
Badly. there's some evidence he was actually at Bosworth, but no evidence he fought. So he would have been kept out of the fighting. Maybe because, he had something to do. That's a lot of people think that because of the princes, but it would have been strange to keep him that close to battle then. It may have been that Richard just kept him out because, first of all, he can't fight. And second of all, like this, he will survive if something happens to me. And then he, after the battle was lost, he went to Sanctuary in Colchester, St. John's Abbey.
Yeah.
So you could seek sanctuary even if you had technically committed treason, and then you couldn't be pulled out. Mm. So he seems to have been expected he would be declared a traitor and went to sanctuary. It wasn't uncommon. For example, John Howard, that's later the Duke of Norfolk, had been in that very same sanctuary during the Lancastrian readaption in 1471. Mm. So, yeah. And then... nobody seems to have thought this very strange. And then Henry VII offered him a pardon and he declined it.
Wow. So he, that is incredible. So he's offered a pardon and he declines it. And does he stay in Sanctuary? Does he stay hidden?
He stays in Sanctuary, probably not hidden because he would have been brought to pardon there, the offer of pardon. But yes, he stayed there. And the abbot of that abbey, he was known to be a Yorkist, so that probably helped. And they were planning a rebellion from there on.
Amazing.
In 1486, that rebellion was basically planned from Sanctuary on, because there's a whole list of people who were later pardoned for minor offenses in that rebellion, and they're all from Colchester. Usually you stayed in Sanctuary for 40 days. After that, you could be pulled out. That's okay. You could stay in Sanctuary 40 days, plot whatever you did, and then you had to leave. But Colchester, St. John's Abbey in Colchester, had extended rights of Sanctuary, as did Westminster Abbey, for example. So you could stay there technically for as long as you wanted. And it's often, this is a point that's often used. Oh, he stayed in Sanctuary longer than 40 days, so maybe he was planning something. Or Henry VII was negotiating something about the princess, but it's not that deep. It just had longer rights of Sanctuary. And, well, he just seems to have used that to plot a rebellion. We actually know that he ran up a lot of debts, that's something like 20,000 in modern money. And later on, Cecily Neville paid them. She arranged it in her will that it would be paid. But we do not know what for. We don't know how he ran up all these debts.
I wonder how you run up debts in Sanctuary.
I have no idea. I could imagine maybe it's physicians or something. We don't know if he was maybe injured at Bothworth. Yeah. But I'm just guessing.
Or a lot of Deliveroo.
Yeah, probably. And Netflix.
He got all the subscriptions. He's just chilling out, eating a load of takeaway. But no, he must have been working pretty hard, because does he actually attempt to assassinate Henry the Seventh?
Yes, twice.
Yes,
he started a rebellion together with Humphrey and Thomas Stafford. That's two retainers of Richard. This was in 1486 during Henry VII's first tour of the country. And he tried to raise that rebellion, but it was dead in the water, much like the Buckingham Rebellion. Nobody really supported it because, he didn't even offer an alternative. He just said, we are killing him. And who's, I don't know, I don't care, just killing him. So it wasn't the best planned. And when his men went away, then his original plan was just kidnapping Henry, and then probably staging an execution for him, sort of a trial and execution. And when that didn't work, he just went to York and tried to kill him.
Just straight up went to try and kill him.
To try and kill him and escaped.
Amazing. God.
Yes, I don't know how, but it would have been quite impressive, I'm sure.
So, I mean, he's fiercely loyal. He's incredibly persistent. He's just not very effective.
Yes, that's the thing. He's good at organizing, and he showed that when he was Lord Chamberlain, but he's just not good at any sort of military or violence or anything.
So he flees. He runs away to the continent. But he's still not done, is he, in trying to get rid of Henry, is he?
No, he's not. And then this time he gets the support of Richard's sister, Margaret, Duchess of the widowed Duchess. I can never
Dowager.
Pronounce that word. Dowager. Dowager Duchess of Burgundy. And her son-in-law or stepson-in-law, that's Maximilian, later Maximilian I, Holy Roman Empire. At that time, he was king of the Romans. And he gets their support. And Margaret was always off supporting rebels against Henry VII. Also, it's partly, of course, he killed her brother, and partly because Henry VII had been supported by the French, who did not like the Burgundians, etc., etc. So yes, he goes to her and gets her support there. And then he's also in contact with Richard's oldest nephew. That's John Earl of Lincoln, John de la Pole, Earl of Lincoln. Actually, there's some evidence that John de la Pole had been in contact with Francis the whole time. He'd been his foster brother for a while after the Earl of Warwick died. Francis had been made the ward of Lincoln's parents, and they've been quite close, so they would have known each other from quite early on. And there's several pieces of evidence that this rebellion in 1486 had been betrayed by somebody, and then Francis was given the news and could change his plans accordingly. And this is almost certainly was John de la Pole passing on this information.
Fantastic. So they are they involved in the Lambert Simnel affair?
That's the one,
Basically.
yes.
Right. So this I find fascinating because we've had Matt Lewis from the Richard III Society talk to us about this before. And his suggestion is that at that time, John de la Pole's got a very, very good claim to the throne as the
Yes.
Yorkist heir. And there's only one person who would be more eligible to the throne than John de la Pole. And that would be one of the princes.
Yes, as it stood by law at the time, one of the princes would have been king, because Henry the Seventh had, of course, overturned the Titulus Regius. That's what gave Richard his claim. So basically, it was Edward was made king through that, Edward the Fifth. Yeah. So, but after Richard's death, before Henry changed the law, which of course he had to do, then John de la Pole was king. By law, he was king then, because he was the oldest nephew. The others had been plucked through law. So yeah, this is another thing. It's always claimed that Lambert Simnel impersonated Edward of Warwick, but Edward of Warwick was barred from the throne because his father had been executed. So there's no point, even if it was the real one, to put a 12-year-old with a plighted claim on the throne when you had a perfectly grown-up adult heir with a spotless claim.
So why would they?
Yes.
So you've got this man who is doggedly loyal, not
Yeah,
very
to be fair,
effective.
I don't think he cared. He could have put a monkey on the throne. He just wanted
He
Henry dead.
just wanted Henry off. I love that. I was going to argue that if he is that loyal to the family, and if John de la Pole's saying, I could be king myself, but I'm not going to do it while this kid's alive, if that lends weight to Lambert Simnel as being who he proposed that he was.
It could be. It's hard to say always. You can always or argue one side or the other. But yeah, it definitely could be, because Francis did not care. He started a whole rebellion without even a counter candidate. But John de la Pole had actually, I do not know how, but Henry absolutely adored him.
Wow.
He barely even, he had to, of course, punish some of Richard's supporter, take some stuff from him. He barely took anything from him. He even made him in 1486, together with his uncle and the Earl of Oxford, both of whom had been in exile with Henry, and then Lincoln. They were the three who were supposed to investigate the treasons of the whole rebellion. Then Lincoln suggested that they pardon the whole lot, except Francis, obviously, and Henry went and pardoned them. I do not know what Lincoln did, but he had the best position in Henry's court. So something must have been happened for him. Something must have happened that he decided, I'm going to rebel.
Wow.
Because he could have worked his way up. He played Henry like a fiddle.
That's so interesting. God. So look, how does it end up for Lovell, our very rebellious, lovely friend? How does it end for him? Do we know?
No, we don't know. We know he survived the Battle of Stoke. That's Lincoln died there, but he survived. He was last seen swimming with his horse over the River Trent. He was escaping, of course, because he didn't want to be taken prisoner. And then nothing. There's for a year later, there's a 17th safe conduct to Scotland for him, but that seems to have been got by Margaret of Burgundy, but there's no evidence he ever even took it. So we don't know. He may have died in between those two dates. We also know his wife was looking for him in around 1.5 years after the Battle of Stoke, saying that she had sent one of his retainers to look for him in the north, but had not found anything, which is interesting because the retainer was also attainted. And so she was casually committing treason to find him. He hadn't found anything, and that's the last we know. So I think it's possible he went to Burgundy again, where he was safe, then to maybe wanted to go to Scotland to plot on from there. Because the Scottish were always against the English, and actually the north of the country was so ticked off at Henry VII winning that they started to plot with the Scots, with whom they had been arguing for centuries, to invade and throw him off the throne. So maybe he thought this was a good place, but maybe he was injured again, maybe he just became ill. There's no evidence that he was alive after maybe a month or two after the Battle of Stoke.
Gosh. I mean, this is the problem when you study an area and you know all of the possible things that could have happened. But do you have one that you think more than the other? What do you think happened to him?
I think he died. He may have died in Burgundy shortly after the Battle of Stoke, because there were other rebellions soon afterwards. There were 13 biggish ones, I think, in Henry VII's reign, and he's not mentioned in any of them after 1487, and I do not think he would have given up. So it's probably very likely that he died. What he died of, he wasn't the most healthy man to start with, though maybe it was just too much. But I don't know. I think he died in 1487.
Because he wouldn't have stopped.
No. He was quite stubborn, really.
I like that. There's all these wonderful legends about him haunting Minster Lovell.
Oh, he never even liked Minster Lovell. He was barely there.
It's lovely there.
I know, but he was barely there. His grandfather, William Lovell, had it rebuilt really nicely in 1430s. Mm-hmm. And then Francis went and just had it rebuilt entirely again. And then he never even went there.
No, he never went there.
No, it's barely there.
So all the things about him haunting it are complete rubbish.
I've always said if there's a skeleton buried there, that's more likely to be his very, very unpopular father than him. That. Somebody whacked him over the head. He was very unpopular. He was also, we do not know what exactly happened, but we do know that he made his Francis' mother, that is pregnant, for the first time when she was 13. And he was 22 or something. So yeah, he was a terrible man. And there's some hiccup about his death, so maybe that if there's a skeleton, that's him. Maybe he's haunting the one, it's not Francis.
That's wonderful. I love it. So why write the book about Viscount Lovell? Is it fair to say you're living the dream?
Absolutely, yes. I was looking up, I was reading something about Richard Oates years and years ago, and I was trying to chase something up about that Viscount I read about. This is funny. What did he do there? And I just found nothing. There is so little about him. And it was just, okay, if there's nothing, I'm just going to have to find it. And it just fell down that rabbit hole and never came back. I figured if there's the book I want to read isn't out there, I'm just going to have to write it.
That's wonderful. Well, I'm really looking forward to reading this, Michelle. So check out, guys, Lovell Our Dog, The Life of Viscount Lovell by the wonderful Michelle Schindler. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack. or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.